So we're going to begin by turning to page 148 in your missalettes and singing, "Greater to the smiling God I am to thee." So we're off to a good start. Thank you so much for being here. Heard of these guys? This here is Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner. How many of you actually listen to the podcast, Welcome to Night Vale? Well, all right.
Oh, thank you.
So you have a familiar crowd here. And or read the first novel, the Welcome to Night Vale novel. Great. You're going to love It Devours if you have not yet read it. So thrilled to have you guys here. And from what I understand, I'd love to hear a little bit more about the origins of this collaboration that you've done. My understanding is you met when you were at the New York Neo-Futurist. Uh-huh. Jeffrey, you were working there. Joseph, you were a volunteer there. Is that so?
Yeah.
How did you know you wanted to work together?
We got to know each other. With the New York Neo-Futurists, you perform every week and do new plays constantly, and it's always churning. So I was in the show quite a bit, and when Joseph would come, he also did some workshops with us. So you get a sense of, I would get a sense of Joseph's writing and was always really excited by it. I always thought it was really, original and different and cool. And so he would get to see me on stage. And so we just spent a lot of time, after shows, everyone just kind of goes across the street to one of the worst bars in New York City. But it was $2.50 PBR, so we would all hang out.
And also, because it was so terrible, no one was ever there, which so it was never crowded.
You could always just get a big table. So we just spent a lot of time just talking to each other and hanging out, and we had a lot of similar interests and liked a lot of the same, playing with the same ideas as writers. And then I think it was somewhere in 2010, eventually we were just we should just write something together. And so we decided to write a play together.
A play, and how did it turn into a podcast? I mean, this is 2012 is when the podcast came out.
Yes.
Right. So, very few, there are podcasts out there. This American Life is doing great stuff. WTF is doing great stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is wholly original. How did you come up with the idea?
So we did that play. We did it in the summer of 2011. And I really enjoyed that process of writing with Jeffrey. And so I wanted, and also we were both big fans of podcasts at the time. And so I knew I wanted to make a podcast with Jeffrey, and I didn't want it to sound like This American Life or WTF, because those already existed and were doing it better than we could. But there really wasn't much in the way of fiction. There were a few shows, but nothing that was particularly well-known at the time. And so because we were fiction writers, that just seemed like something we could do. So I started a couple things happened. Was that when I got fired from my job in January, and then also my dad died that summer, the summer before. So it was a very transitional point in my life, and I just started, it wasn't until years later looking back that I realized it was a lot of ways just trying to deal with my grief. But I just started writing about this desert town, and it just didn't it wasn't like I'm writing a script. I would just write paragraphs. The very first thing I wrote was this paragraph from the first episode of the show about the lights above the Arby's. I just one day wrote that, and then I'm like, this is good. I'm gonna keep writing stuff like it. And eventually I had a lot of just paragraphs about this town, and I put some of them together into a test episode. Made it with our friend Cecil, who I also knew through the theater company, Woo. with the music from my friend John, who I'd known for years, and who had just a ton of music online.
John Darnell?
No, John Bernstein, who goes by Disparition. He does all the instrumental music in the background of Night Vale is all him. And that was mostly just music that was already out there. So I made that test episode, and I showed it to Jeffrey, and I was like, I don't know, I'm kind of thinking this. What do you think?
Yeah. I was thinking about the idea of you spend a lot of time as a writer being like, okay, I have to create a thing, I have to build a thing, and then I have to give it to people and pitch it to somebody and do all of this work to just get something up and off the ground. And then for Night Vale, it was just really amazing that one day I just get an email attachment from Joseph, which is like, here, listen to this, see what you think. And it's the pilot episode as it exists now. No changes were made to that. And he was like, does this sound good? Mm-hmm. So that was really exciting just to be able to have somebody already sort of create the initial episode that kind of sets a tone for something, and it was really fun to sit down after that and sort of start writing the next four, five, six episodes together.
Well, in this conceit of the community radio announcer talking about what's going on in this, you're just plopped into the action like in some kind of alien country, I think is probably the best description for it. So how did you come up with that kind of conceit that it would be like the community radio report?
I mean, a lot of that came out of the theater scene we were in. You know, people making theater in New York, especially downtown theater, there's not a lot of money being thrown around there because everyone's trying to survive in New York. And so there's a lot of very simple shows in terms of the technical execution of it. And I really enjoy that. It was a real revelation to me seeing these shows that really could take you somewhere and show you a story and immerse you in a world when it was just a person standing in their street clothes on a bare stage talking to you. That happened to me over and over again in New York theater, and I really loved it. I loved it in many ways more than a big Broadway show that, you know, swings a chandelier at you.
For example.
Shouting out Hamilton, I know.
Yeah.
So the community radio thing was less about the radio and more about trying to recreate that feeling. Mm. I really wanted to have a thing where it was just a voice talking to you with basically no sound effects, no other characters, nothing like that. Just a person telling you a story and trying to make that as interesting as you could.
Yeah. And Cecil, as everyone who knows the podcast, narrates what's going on. He's the community radio announcer and Welcome to Night Vale, the podcast. He's referred to and commented on as a character in the first novel. He's not in this novel so much.
He's in it.
He's in it, but he's... So you've chosen to create another form of narrative, and I'm wondering about, you know, is that liberating for you to kind of leave that behind, or what did that mean for you? What were the challenges?
Well, I think when we set out to write anything, the first question is always, what's the medium and how do you write toward that? So writing something for the stage is way different than writing something for a podcast versus a novel. And when we set out to write the first novel, the big thing was we can't write it in the style of the podcast because there's no such thing as a 400-page radio show. And it just didn't make any sense. People would be holding a book and reading it in their own minds to themselves. So it gave us a chance to take it out of Cecil's first-person account of everything and to really use author voice to be more omniscient, to see more of the town, to follow these other characters. So I guess in some ways that's, it's liberating, but it's just more of just you have the excitement of say, yeah, we can really explore the town without having to filter it through one character's interpretation of what's happening. It gives you a chance to get more into, say, a character like Carlos is a big player in this novel. And that was a lot of fun to see Carlos at work rather than through the eyes of his husband.
Yeah.
And I think that gives you a lot more, as a writer, it's really fulfilling to be able to play with that more and explore his character that way.
What else does writing a novel allow you to do differently than a podcast?
This is going to sound like a really flippant answer, but it is a big part of the truth, which is a novel is way longer than a podcast. Just writing a 2,500-word short story and then writing a novel that takes place in the same world, it allows you to do completely different things. You really have to think about the story in a different way. With a podcast, we kind of play it by ear a lot. You know, we do a lot of throwing things out that seem really interesting and then just kind of following where they go. And you can't do that in a novel. Everything has to land somewhere and everything has to be there for a reason. To me, it's fun to have that challenge of taking the same world but painting a much bigger picture story and also doing a thing of everything in this book, we need to figure out how it ties together and why it's in here in a way that with a podcast we can just sometimes have stuff happen because it seems interesting at the time.
Yeah, so what are your rules for that? I mean, like, crazy stuff happens in Night Vale, as you guys know. There's a dog park that doesn't allow dogs. Mm-hmm. In the book, the NRA motto is, guns are the new kale. Guns are healthy as all get out.
That's the actual NRA motto.
Yeah, that was just us recording.
Okay, so that's not... sorry, I thought it was fiction for a moment. But there are these ways of kind of presenting the surreal, right? To underscore the kind of absurdity of the real world, I think. That's not easy to get right. I mean, is it for you guys? I mean, is there a way that you edit each other? What's that process like?
Well, I mean, in terms of getting the absurd
just right, to where you're not being too on the nose or being so strange that it just takes somebody completely out of the story where they're trying to parse your sentence. I think that those are the big things. And that really just comes down to, you know, taste, like knowing what this sentence should sound like and where it should be going. But yeah, in terms of the process, it makes doing something like this a lot easier when you have a co-writer, because you, you know, for say the episodes are 2,500 words approximately. So for it usually is one person writes that and then passes it to the next, and ostensibly we just alternate episodes for the most part. So you always have somebody else kind of reading and making sure that your main characters have some agency and some arc and also that everything makes sense and that you're leading someplace. Also to just do things like, here, I added a funny joke on the fourth page, see if you think it's funny. and things like that. And the same thing with the novel is to make sure that you have somebody there to kind of help with that process.
Yeah, the jokes, so one of the, at the Church of the Smiling God, they're warming up the PA system with 10 instrumental odes to a smiling God by Bono. There's a barista's union that, you know, pretty much refuses to serve you coffee, mm-hmm. because why should they be bothered? It's just so, there are all these funny little comments on what goes on in the world. So any that you hit on and just think, yes, I hit it on that one.
Oh, in terms of jokes?
Yeah.
Oh, man. probably. I can't think of any in specific. I mean, I feel like, especially with this, I mean, the tricky thing with a book, we're so used to a podcast, right. Where you write a script and at most maybe a month, or if we're really on top of it, which we almost never are, 2 months from then, mm-hmm. the episode comes out. And here, you know, we finished writing this in like October, September of 2016. And so it can be, sometimes people will reference something in this book, mm-hmm. and then there will have to be a moment of just, I don't remember that. yeah, I mean, I always try to make sure that everything in Night Vale matches a feeling mm-hmm. in my stomach. Huh. As Jeffrey was saying, like, a lot of it is just knowing what it's supposed to sound like. You know, it's sort of like chefs, like a big part of being a chef is you need to know what the food is supposed to taste like so that you can know if you made it right. And I think it's a similar thing with being a writer is you should know what good writing looks like by having read a lot of it, but also you should just know specifically the writing you're going for, what you want it to look like, so that you can look at a sentence and either be like, yeah, that is right, or no, that is in the right ballpark, but it's gonna need some more work before it gets there.
Yeah. Any other rules, like for continuity? I think fantasy readers, science fiction readers, horror readers, we are kind of trained, or mystery readers, you know, to mm-hmm. know what the world looks like, right? Mm-hmm. The world that you're creating. Is that something you talk about, you know, the placement of things? It's interesting. There's physicality definitely in Night Vale, but we don't get a lot of, you know, descriptions of what someone looks like necessarily, for example.
Yeah, in terms of the visual descriptions of people, a lot of that is just, that goes back to the taste thing. I think Joseph and I have both long just been disinterested in that, where we just kind of like gloss over what somebody looks like. There's obviously some like certain cues, like we have a character, the man in the tan jacket, right? So obviously we've given some visual cue to what the person is dressed as, but then his whole ethos is nobody remembers what he looks like. So I think we're always sort of playing with that idea, but we don't spend a lot of time on character appearances because it oftentimes seems sort of irrelevant to the plot. But in terms of the... what was the first part of that? I'm sorry.
So the question is about, like, are there any rules that you guys have about writing?
I think the number one thing about when we set out to do the podcast, and the same with the novel, is that Night Vale can be anything we want it to be as long as it has strict continuity. And I think for us, a lot of what continuity means is that when characters make a decision, when something happens to somebody or they do a thing, that has consequences, that has consequences for them and for other people, and that people are getting older, that they're growing, that they're changing, that things change them. You know, some characters may not actually technically age, but they are getting older. You know, things are happening to them. And so I think the idea that they're growing up and they're changing and evolving just like a real town.
Even if they can stay 19 forever.
Even if they stay 19 forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anything too weird? I mean, do you guys come up with stuff and think like, oh, come on, that's just out of the park?
No. Definitely not too definitely not too weird. I mean, you know, from the very after when our very first meeting when we sat down to talk about what is this show, kind of the rule we came to was it can be as weird as we want. There is just no limit there. It just needs to have strict continuity. Because as long as you have strict continuity, then it doesn't matter how weird the world you're creating is. It starts to build the weight of everything that has happened in it and the consequences of those, and it starts to feel real. So I'd never worry about, is this too weird? I definitely worry about, does this feel right for what we're doing? One we often point to is, I think we've both had times where, so we do a live show, and we sometimes have cast members from the show who can drop in for one or two of the shows, and unlike most podcasts, when that happens, that means Jeffrey and I have to write a scene for them. So we do a lot of just being like, I need to write a scene for Kevin R. Free, who plays Kevin on the show, or whoever. And you want those to fit into the feeling of the show. So for instance, I once wrote one for Kevin that I just got this idea about time travel and seeing him at different ages, and I started writing this thing that was it's supposed to be like a little 5-minute guests drop in, and it ended up being probably about 15 minutes long and just was super complicated and had like a plot twist, and it became pretty clear to me that I had just written something that needed to be taken away. I eventually turned it into a full episode for the show, but it didn't work for that. And Jeffrey, you had a thing with another character.
We have a character named Earl Harlan, who is who's a chef at the hip restaurant Tourniquet. And Earl. Will Wheaton plays Earl Harlan when we are in L.A. Sometimes he's able to pop in, and he was able to do a show. And like, I'm gonna write this Earl part. And I tried to play on that old trope of the TV chef who puts alcohol in all of his food, and then like the idea that that person. I was trying to play on that trope, right? Like, what can I do with that? And then what ended up happening is I was like, I don't want it to be where it just becomes funny because he's drunk. I need to, like, play on, like, what that really means. And what it ended up becoming was a really, really sad story about a person abusing alcohol and being really upset at their life. And I'm like, I can't put this in the show. Like, that, it's not about being too weird. It was about being too real for a thing that was... maybe that could be part of Earl's character, but it was just not, our live shows are, they may hit hard and they may have like really, really sincerely deep and dramatic moments, but for the most part, like, it's trying to keep the energy up for the most part and not also just really making poor Will come all the way out to downtown LA and do a 5-minute part that makes everyone just deflate. So, you have those moments too where you have to remember how to play that just right.
Just made me think, Joseph, the kind of Hitchcockian idea of inserting yourself as a character in some kind of cameo in the series. Have you ever thought about that, or what kind of character you'd make for yourself?
I mean, here's where I've thought about that. I would like to have a cameo in a horror movie. This is a life goal for me. Mm-hmm. So if anyone knows anyone making a horror movie, that's just a separate subject that I would like to have a cameo in it. There was a horror writer or screenwriter I really like who was like, I'll put you in my next movie. And I got very excited, and then I've not heard anything since. I don't know. Never think about putting myself in Night Vale. We only have one real person in Night Vale, who is the YA author, Maureen Johnson. And how that happened is, so we have these interns at the community radio station that, as interns often do, just regularly die. Uh-huh. And generally, we name those interns after friends of ours. And so we named, we had an intern, Maureen, for Maureen Johnson, and something unfortunate happened to her, surprisingly, and Maureen Johnson started a Twitter campaign against us to bring back Maureen, and then Jeffrey went to her and was like, we'll bring you back, but you have to play her. And then that's just how Maureen Johnson showed up in Night Vale fully formed, like we're just writing the person.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So maybe next a Twitter campaign to get Joseph Fink a cameo role in a horror film?
Yeah. Let's make that happen.
But like, please don't annoy anyone.
So we didn't really talk about the setup for this novel. This is Larry Leroy's house disappears into a sinkhole, mm-hmm. right at the beginning. And this woman, Nilanjana Sikdar, She's a scientist, comes to town. She's an outsider. She's mm-hmm. been in Night Vale for 4 years. People still point and shout interloper to her when they see her on the road. So tell us about the creation of this character, an outsider. What kind of perspective does she bring?
Well, as a part of Carlos's scientific lab, you know, Carlos being the scientist of note in the podcast, you know, all of the scientists came to Night Vale from someplace else. And so it was really interesting to sort of like decide that we wanted to be in Carlos's lab with these scientist characters. And then once you realize that they are all outsiders, it gives you a totally different perspective on how to build out the world of Night Vale, because you can make the strangeness of Night Vale a little stranger by putting it through the eyes of somebody who's not from there. So, you know, for somebody who regularly lives there, the idea of like shouting interloper and pointing at them, it might be as common as just saying howdy to somebody in the South. And but you know, from Nilanjana's point of view, that idea of that is sort of off-putting and upsetting. And so you can sort of deal with that a little bit more. And also kind of the ups and downs of like some of it is confusion on her behalf. Some of it is actual terror of like, why does this town work like this? And some of it is just annoyance. Like, there's just, this town is so weird. Like, I can't just get a simple, like, I just can't get my driver's license renewed is all I'm trying to do. And people keep like biting my paperwork and then setting it on fire.
Well, she also brings she explains things. You know, she's got hypotheses. She's trying to understand what's going on in this place. And it's got a little clip here from the book. We see things all the time that we can't explain and we take them for granted, like clouds. There are some scientists who will say that clouds are water droplets that rise in the sky, forming these gray or white puffs. Unless you're a cloud scientist, you'll never have a chance to test that information. You have to take what people tell you as the truth. There's this whole truth, bizarro world, mm-hmm. and faith, you know, a lot of things run through this. And I'm curious about like this idea of, I don't know, one of my colleagues said, it's like reclaiming the mystery of everything around us. Is that how you look at Night Vale? You know, this idea of we walk past clouds, we see light, there are these things we can't explain, but there's wonder there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm going to swerve very slightly, but it is related in my head, which is, I really love the horror genre, which Night Vale slightly touches on occasionally. But the reason I love it is because in a lot of ways, horror feels more real to me than realistic dramas. Realistic dramas often feel like they're recreating life, but they often don't feel like life. Because I feel like life, when you're in it, often feels very inexplicable and confusing and anxiety-inducing, and there's stuff happening that you don't understand, you can't control, and there's not really a way to protect yourself from other than to just hope that you'll be okay. And so when you watch a horror movie where that stuff is manifested by like a masked killer or by a ghost, the emotions it evokes feels more real to me than a realistic drama. A horror movie often feels more like real life to me than realism. Mm. And so I think that it's the same with Night Vale, where our attempt is to create a world that is weird but evokes the emotions that we feel about the world we live in.
Were you going to say
no,
something?
Please, please. No, go ahead.
Well, but still, you know, people are living in this horror or these crazy things happening around them. But still, you know, getting their morning coffee, mm-hmm. going on dates, showing up for work, raising kids. And to kind of cap on what you were just saying, our world feels out of control and bizarre a lot. Mm-hmm. Is that the idea here, that, you know, we can just keep our head down and pass by it or stop and take notice of it? What's going on here for
you
guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we do get that comment a lot of, like, Night Vale is horrifying and scary, and I'm like, well, our normal world is too. It's just, like, where there might be something like, where there might be dragons or hooded figures in Night Vale. We have things like flesh-eating bacteria in our world, which I was just reading an article on the other day, and you just realize, like, wow, here's a completely invisible force that eats you from the outside in. And we all just sort of say, well, that's just a thing that happens. In the same way that someone in Knightville is like, well, yeah, interns always die at the radio station. It doesn't affect me. I'm not going to be a radio intern.
I was just at the Atlas Obscura presentation earlier today, and she was talking about this group of monks that in the 19th century self-mummified over the course of 10 years by eating a strict regimen of things that lacquered their organs while they were still alive. And so I do have to wonder about people who worry that Knightville might be too weird.
But still, such funny things happen. I'm thinking of, oh my gosh, the former high school quarterback who grows two heads.
Michael Sandero.
Yes, Michael Sandero, mm-hmm. And his mother thinks, I like the one more than the other. It's much handsomer, and it doesn't talk back as much. Uh-huh. I mean, where do you guys come up with this stuff?
I don't know. It's a good question for a neurologist, right? Like, where do ideas come from? Like, I'm never quite sure. I mean, I think a lot of it just comes from, you read a lot of stuff, you're sort of attracted to the absurd, and with the development of, as we've gone on writing Night Vale, the podcast and these novels and things, we've sort of developed this voice, this kind of comfort with a very specific voice that is for Night Vale, that's kind of actually different from the voice Joseph may have writing on his own or me writing on my own. And so you're always kind of feeding that specific style. To bring it back to the idea of making an allusion to a chef, right? This is that this is a certain type of cuisine, right? Like there are certain spices you use in this food, in this Night Vale show, that you may not use if you write something else that are particular to that. So there is a thing where you're looking for, okay, well, I'm gonna write a sports story. I'm gonna write it about this quarterback. You know, what can I do to make sports different in some way? And it would seem, and I think about growing up a sports fan, and I grew up in Texas where high school football was such a major deal. And I remember there's always some story, we had it at our own school, of there were scandals about grades being altered to keep students in there, or a student just barely missing a grade and then your star player then can't play in the playoffs or whatever. So there's always some type of controversy and things like that. So I thought, well, this makes sense in Night Vale that there would be some controversy, that it's it's not fair that quarterback has two heads.
Well, like small towns everywhere, the little whisper campaigns, little conspiracy theories. And do you guys follow conspiracy theories?
Well, define follow. I've always loved conspiracy theories, and most of them I don't believe. So some of them are just self-evidently true. But
wait, huh?
Well, number stations, for instance, are a thing that are absolutely real. Mm-hmm. And their use is pretty easy to deduce.
Number stations, the radio stations that just do numbers?
Just do numbers.
Do you guys know what this is? Do you need a little explanation, Joseph? Can you explain?
Sure. They are. They can be found all over the world in almost every language. They've been going on kind of as long as commercial radio. And they are stations that just play. They often play some sort of chime or tone or song, and then occasionally it'll break in with just a emotionless voice reading a long list of numbers. There's variations on it, but if you want to have a nightmarish time, you can go on YouTube and listen to them. This is a 100% real thing that exists. I mean, the best guess, and almost certainly what they are, is they are governments communicating to spies, because then you don't actually need a spy to check in at all. They can just listen to that radio station and write down the coded numbers, and then their use is pretty easy to figure out, but there has not been in the almost 100 years they've existed, there has not been a single document released proving what they are. No one has ever admitted to owning a number station or explained anything about the use of them. So there is no official information on what a number station is. I really enjoy even conspiracy theories I don't believe in, because I think that they are fantastic stories. And I think they function in many ways as religious stories, which I'm also fascinated with, in that they exist to explain why things happen, because the answer is usually because the world is random and cruel. But that's not an answer we like very much. So we would prefer, you know, the example Jeffrey uses a lot is the Kennedy assassination, which we learned all sorts of fun things about this week. But the idea that someone that powerful and well-liked could be murdered just by someone with a rifle who happened to be there is a really horrifying thought, and it's so much easier to believe and better for your, like, understanding of the state of the world to believe, oh, that had to have been this grand plot, and there had to have been all these people involved. Because that, in a lot of ways, even no matter how complex you make that, it ultimately is easier for our brains to comprehend than the president can be killed just because a guy happened to sneak a rifle into a book depository.
Jeffrey, is there anything you want to add there?
No, I mean,
other conspiracy theories you follow?
Yeah, I think the Kennedy assassination is a big one, and growing up in Dallas, that's always like top of mind every November, and is always talked about. I think my favorite sort of, it's not really a conspiracy theory, I guess, which is the Denver airport. Are you guys familiar? Like most, I see a lot of heads nodding. Shake your head no if you don't know what I mean by the Denver airport. So the idea of the Denver
airport,
it's an airport, and that's it. Like I don't believe it's real. I hope it's real. We fly there tomorrow.
Oh God.
So the whole idea of the Denver airport was in the 1980s they had an airport and it was close to town. It was fine. It was great. It worked great. And then there became this thing of like we need a brand new airport, and they built it. It's about an hour away from downtown Denver, kind of in the middle of nowhere, straight east of there. And it was this billion-dollar project that ballooned to multi-billions of dollars of and also a large portion of it was privately funded. And it was also not clear exactly who was funding the airport. There is a plaque near the Denver airport that states something about crediting the New World Order, which goes back to like the whole under the lizard people sort of thing, the Illuminati. And anyways, but the other thing about it was there were people that reported when the airport was being constructed, these giant scaffolded tent setups that are usually built for when you are digging deep underground, and there are no deep underground structures known at the Denver airport. And so it became this belief that people were building these giant underground bunkers for world leaders or the super wealthy to escape to if anything goes wrong. There was actually, back in the Obama administration, there was a moment where he had scheduled a talk in Denver, that kind of out of the blue at some smaller university
like
there.
Very last minute.
Very last minute scheduling, and it was around the exact same time that there was one of the closest passings of a comet near the Earth, and so everyone's like, "Oh, he's getting to the Denver airport. I get this." But but the other thing is that, or just like, I don't know if the world's going to be in, Rocky Mountains are beautiful. There's a giant horse statue that, this did happen, it killed its sculptor by falling on him. And if you ever see, Google the Denver airport horse and you will have great nightmares. Do it while listening.
It literally has glowing red eyes.
And they put like veins in it. People take pictures of it during thunderstorms because it's so scary. And then finally, there were these murals, and they've been taken down, and you'll find out why. But they put these giant murals up that depicted basically a global apocalypse, and it starts off showing with a giant figure wearing like head to toe like capes and armor and a gas mask, and in one hand he has an AK-47, and in the other hand a scimitar, and he is stabbing a dove out of the air while two children hide under a rock near him. And then there's another shot of this forest completely enveloped in flames, and then a group of like sobbing people burying dead animals into glass boxes. And then eventually this kind of like super apocalyptic narrative develops into a situation where you finally see that soldier figure with the scimitar and the machine gun has been killed, and he is lying dead, and the children are over him smiling. And then the last picture is just all the children of the world represented with all their different flags, and they've, you know, they're pounding swords into plowshares, and they're hammering the swords into whatever. And at the center is this very like, it's really weird to say, there's this very Aryan-looking child holding the Bible or just holding a great book out like this while the kids hover over that. one time in a line, sorry, one time we were in a line and there's like a little thing where you drop coins into, like at an airport, but it just is a tube that goes straight into the ground. And I was like, I have excess coins. And I put it in there, and our friend Liza turned to that and she was like, that's what the lizard people eat. So check out Denver Airport, the end.
So our producer just elegantly showed me and discreetly showed me a sign, and I'm trying to decide which sign that was exactly.
It was the good story sign.
Well, you know what? That's a really conspiracy theory sign. I'm not wearing my glasses, so I don't know what that says.
I think we can go to the reading.
Okay. Time to go to the reading. Our guests, Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, have a little bit to read, and then we're going to get to your questions. There is, we're going to set up a microphone right there. It is right there in the center aisle, and let you ask some questions too.
Great. All right. Here is a short excerpt from early on in the book. Nilanjana had no interest in Carlos, and anyway, he was married to the local community radio host Cecil Palmer. Still, she couldn't not notice that he was, in his way, stunningly handsome. Even his frown was perfect, and he ran his hands perfectly through his perfect hair. In science, of course, there's always a lot of pressure to look good. Appearances are a major part of a science career, and top scientists face all sorts of accusations of plastic surgery and unhealthy diets, a constant scrutiny in gossip magazines and tabloid blogs. But Carlos stayed out of all of that. He was a beautiful person, but that never interested him much. He only cared about two things, his scientific work and his family. Nilanjana didn't know Carlos's family well. She knew his teenage niece, Janice, was born with spina bifida, and while her frequent checkups of eyes, kidneys, and spine came back healthy each time, Carlos would take days off work to be with her and his brother and sister-in-law. Nilanjana knew that his husband Cecil sometimes faced serious dangers as a reporter in a town as full of terrible secrets as Nightvale, and those dangers sent Carlos into a worried stupor. He would pace about the office trying not to call the station to ask if Cecil was okay. Not much got done in the lab when Carlos fretted for Cecil's safety. She could tell when Carlos had a date night planned because he put gel in his hair and wore his most striking lab coat. She was uncertain why Carlos wanted to talk to her now. She hoped that the problem was with his scientific work. She didn't have much to say on the subject of being in love. Not that she hadn't had boyfriends. She was a human being of adult age with an interest in other human beings, and she had been in relationships starting from high school, but she did not feel qualified to offer advice on the subject. She was just stumbling along, the same as anyone. It was occasionally fun and often lonely, whether she was with someone at the time or not. Carlos interrupted this reverie by pulling down a chart that said in large letters, science. Today's topic of discussion is science. I've provided a visual aid. Oh, thank God. He gestured for her to sit, but she didn't like sitting much, and so she gestured that she would rather stand, and there was some gesturing back and forth that neither of them understood. Finally, Carlos sat, and she remained standing. I know you are aware of the house, he began. The general concept of houses? No, the house that doesn't exist. He pulled down another chart. It had a picture of a house on it. Yes, she said, I know that house. It doesn't exist. It looks like it exists, like it's right there when you look at it, and it's between two other identical houses, so it would make more sense for it to be there than not, but it doesn't actually exist. He finished. Right, it's a weird house. Or it isn't a weird house. It's weird, but not a house? It's hard to know how to talk about it. Everyone in town knew about the house that looks like it exists, but doesn't. There was a common dare among scientists to knock on the door and then run away. Carlos himself had once entered the house. He didn't talk much about this. Anytime the topic came up, he would wave it off or try to change the subject. What Nilanjana had learned from his research notes was that its interior was entirely different from that of the common prefab house it seemed to be when one peered through its windows. But seen from the inside, the house contained no furniture and no decorations except a small black and white photo of a lighthouse. The house was not a house, but an entryway to a desert other world, vast and empty. There was a single mountain in that other world, and it was completely believable to all who saw it. At the top of the mountain was the lighthouse from the photo. There had been a cold light emanating from all around, though the sun was never visible. Hypothesis: the desert otherworld had been cold and empty and had made Carlos feel lost to the people he loved. Carlos cared more than anything about the people he loved, and so a place with no one and nothing in it had been traumatizing for him. Ever since Carlos's return from the other world a few years back, everyone in the lab knew he had been obsessed with that house. And like most obsessions with the truth, this had made the city council nervous. "Your job is being a scientist," the council had told him via an empty-eyed child messenger who had helpfully lunged out at him from the shower when he had gotten up to pee in the middle of the night. "So look pretty and write papers. Don't go searching around for the truth. You're a scientist, not a snoop." "Man," said Nilanjana as he told her about the message from the council. "Yes, it was upsetting," said Carlos. "And then, of course, I was stuck with an empty-eyed child messenger. And you know how long it takes the city council to come back around and pick them up. We ended up having to give her rides to school for the next 3 weeks. We're going to her 8th grade graduation tomorrow." "Oh, cute. Super cute. But I won't let the city council dissuade me from preventing anyone else from being hurt by that other world. They have been trying to stop me. Thank you."
Oh. One of the things that comes up in this book is that the basic rule of real estate, existence, existence, existence. So if you have questions, there is a microphone right up here. Try and get to as many as we can.
Hi. Hi. I was wondering where you came up with the concept of the library being not the most welcoming of spots.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different answers to that. One is the surface level that, you know, it's a kind of rule of comedy. You take a thing and you just go the unexpected direction with it. Librarians and libraries are seen as kind of quiet, gentle places and gentle people, and so turning them into monsters is just kind of the direction that seems to make the most sense for a story. But also, there is this thing that librarians are people that have the information, and the people that have the information are powerful and dangerous people. I think librarians are actually a lot more powerful and important than people think, and so turning them into these terrifying monsters is a good way of kind of emphasizing that role that they have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Working at a library, I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know, you can bend the microphone down a little bit.
That's
if
great.
You'd like to.
I'm vertically challenged. So, to go serious on you, how does the current social and political climate affect your art, be it the podcast, writing, even tweeting, or anything else?
Yeah, I mean, it affects it just on a personal level, right? It's hard to, you know, I definitely have days where I'm like, wow, I feel like my energy level is directly related to what is happening in the world in a way that it hasn't been in years past. I mean, the other component of it is that while we have elements of satire in Night Vale, but we never have taken on direct satire necessarily before, and so we try not to be too on the nose about something. But at the same time, you know, Night Vale, its structure of its society is authoritarian. It's invasive. It's kind of like, has a lot of 1984 type elements to it. And so we do want to be a little bit careful about like making authoritarianism cute, right? Like to apologize for terrible behavior, for despotic leadership or something like that. So it's always a balance. You know, the anecdote I use a lot was just that one of my favorite characters to write for is Pamela Winchell, the director of emergency press conferences, who calls these really, really, really weird press conferences, usually about some bigger existential issue. And then I think there's a moment, and I still haven't looked it up, but I think there's a moment in one of the Night Vale episodes where I think she ends a press conference. She always has like a bizarre exit. And she ends a press conference, but I think by like hiding behind a tree or something to that effect. And I was like, wow, Sean Spicer
that would never
literally
happen.
Did that. Like he's like he's stealing our bit. And so I was like, I don't want to make him cute either. So I got to rethink how I write this character. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not vertically challenged. So. So I guess I have like a two-part question. The first would be, did you know Cecil and Carlos would end up together from the beginning of it?
Oh, and okay. Sorry, I didn't know whether you were asking your second part first. No, we didn't really know anything from the beginning. From the beginning, as I said, I just had these paragraphs about a world. I didn't really know who anyone was in it. So I think pretty much all the story choices we made, including that one, were ones that came up as we wrote because it seemed true to the people they were.
Have you created an endpoint now, though, as the stories evolve for you? Do you know where it's going?
Eventually we die, two of us.
Yeah.
And then we can't write anymore.
Best performance is not a predictor of future results.
No, it's not. We never have thought of Night Vale as that kind of story. As Night Vale doesn't ask a question at the start of it. The question isn't, why is Night Vale like this or what is Night Vale? Night Vale's just a place. It's weird, and that's what it is. And so it's more a story of life continuing in that town. We have no grand answer to give in a final episode that we've had written from the start and locked away in a box.
Good.
So the second part is, did you ever have that temptation as writers to go with the everlasting trope of the love triangle? And I'm very glad you didn't, by the
no.
way.
No.
yeah. I don't really have much to expand on other than that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was there any inspiration for Cecil's arguably fantastic fashion choices?
Oh, for Cecil's fashion choices? I mean, some of it comes from Night Vale being weird. And just like, I like the idea that fashion in Night Vale will be super odd, that people will be like, oh yeah, I wear a plastic bag, or I have... Unlike fashion here, which is super normal. No, but I think just like in everyday life, like that you play with those bizarre styles, because it's funny. But I think also like, part of it was, as we've kind of done the show and done live shows and met, been to conventions and things like that, and see like kind of the cosplay look, part of it was just like, man, I really hope I see somebody dressed like this. I'm going to describe a thing that I would really like to see somebody in person wearing. So a little bit of it was partially mischievous in that way.
We get very excited when we see people dressed as a thing we said Cecil wore.
Yeah, like orange rubber boots and plastic bag and cat ears. Yeah.
Furry pants,
yeah. It's pretty cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, my question is, when you were writing the podcast and then later the books, how did you keep track of like all the tiny little details about the characters?
Very imperfectly. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's done, we don't have like a show Bible or anything like that. Mostly we do it by memory. A lot of it we do by, we have everything in shared documents that we can search. And so we can do a lot of like, I'm going to write about this character. I'm just going to search their name and read the like last 10 things we've said about them. So I kind of have a timeline of what's been going on with them lately. So I can kind of make sure that I'm following that story. But I feel like we make mistakes all the time. And I have a philosophical stance that I'm totally okay with that. Because it's a show made by humans and humans aren't perfect. So when we screw up some continuity thing, I personally am just like, I'm okay with that.
Okay, and also, are you going to be writing more of the script books?
Yes.
Thank you.
I should also note that the books are going to be available in the back right after this session. Wellesley Books is selling them, and they'll be signing, so you'll see the script books and the novels as well.
Thank you.
Oh, you know.
All right. I was wondering if I could ask about some of your other podcasts.
Sure.
Is that all right? So I love all of your work, but I feel like for me, the most realistic piece is Alice Isn't Dead. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on perhaps your inspiration for Alice Isn't Dead, like, you know, the Thistlemen and the ties between the Thistlemen and the government. That really intrigues me. Mm-hmm. And I was also wondering if you would ever take Alice Isn't Dead live.
Yeah, Alice Isn't Dead. I mean, it's a little horrifying to me that you think it's realistic. Alice Isn't Dead is a horror podcast I write.
I live in the Midwest. It's kind of like that.
Fair enough.
I'm from Michigan, so.
It came out of, we did Night Vale live tours. You know, we've toured it to 35 states, 16 countries. Mm-hmm. So I've just spent a lot of the last 4 years in a minivan, driving around. And I just started taking notes. And so I had just a ton of travel notes. And I I started putting a story on those, and that kind of turned into Alice. So it was this nice thing of being able to do a little bit of travel writing, but also be able to tell a horror story, because that's what's interesting to me. It started out as just experimenting, and then when Trump got elected, I think it did focus in for me a bit what that show was about. I think the show was already about a portrait of what America feels like right now, but I just didn't really know it. And then after Trump got elected, I realized that's what I was writing and kind of leaned into that a bit more. There actually is going to be at the inaugural PodCon in Seattle in December, which is a podcast convention. We're starting with Hank Green and with the McElroy brothers.
Mm-hmm. Y'all should come. It's a little west of here.
Yeah. It's just a short drive west.
Yeah. Out past Western Mass. Yeah.
We're doing an Alice live show there. As for other ones, it's tricky just working that in. I'm busy, and Jessica is very busy. So.
Well, I'll try to teleport in from Michigan then.
Awesome. Yep.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All hail the mighty glow cloud.
Awesome. So, I liked hearing that in this church. That's great.
So I'm actually a publishing student at Emerson, and I was wondering about your relationship with your editor and how that impacted your release of the book.
We have a great relationship with our editor. We really like her a lot. She's been really supportive and amazing when we came on at Harper Perennial. She was very excited about what we were doing, was very, very much wanting us to make a novel, to write something literary. We definitely had met with other places that were interested in us as popular internet thing. That were like, oh, I could see like a whole like coffee table book of things. And I was like, we don't draw pictures, and you know, that's not how this works. And so, yeah, she really liked what we were writing and liked it as a piece of literary fiction. And that was the thing the reason why we wanted to work with Harper. And so Amy, our editor, has been really fantastic about especially on It Devours, you know, knowing that our goal, like obviously we're setting a novel in the world of Welcome to Night Vale, but it's also, it's a standalone, right? All of these novels will be standalone stories that don't require you to go through 116 episodes of a podcast or read other novels. And so she brought on one of the other Harper editors who actually edits mysteries and thrillers, and so kind of we had kind of a two-editor process, and it was a really helpful thing for us to bring somebody in who wasn't a listener to the show, hadn't already worked on our first novel, and to have like fresh eyes to look at what we're doing. And so things like that, I think, are really helpful for us. It's a really nice, the people at Harper Perennial have been amazing to work with in that way.
Although I have to note, there are two pamphlets in this book that are illustrated. They're just brilliant.
Yeah, an artist we work with named Jessica Hayworth did these amazing end papers with the teeth on them that are so beautiful. And then, you can see closely. but then there's a couple of like really, there's an amazing PowerPoint presentation inside that book, and then also a religious tract that she illustrated that are just stunning in how horrifying they are.
Yeah.
Thank
awesome.
You.
Thank you.
Hi. Do you ever have Cecil Baldwin's voice in your head while you're writing?
No, not really. But I do think about him when I'm writing, when I'm editing something that I know he's going to read. It's the whole thing of writing towards what you're writing with what you're doing in mind. So if I'm writing for his voice, just like if I'm writing for anyone's voice, I try to make sure that it will work with what his performance is. In the same way that if I'm writing for Hal Lublin playing the character Steve Carlsberg, I'll think about his voice. But you know, when I'm writing like a novel or something, then because I'm writing something that's meant to be more or less read silently, I don't really think of his voice now. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank
you. I'm sorry to say that has to be the last question.
Terribly sorry. Oh, we can do one
more.
One more.
Come back.
Yeah.
So Night Vale lore is vast, deep, and ever-growing, and that gives you a lot of tools to build new episodes. Do you ever miss being able to do anything? Do you ever feel constrained by what you've done already?
No, I mean, it's a give and take. Like, once you go down a certain path of characters grow, like, obviously it limits what you can then do with them. You know, if say, Tamika Flynn is getting older, like, she's turning 17 this month, so she can't ever be that 13-year-old in the summer reading program again. She is getting older and soon won't be in high school anymore. There's no summer reading programs anymore. But, you know, that is a limitation, but I like that because I'm like, I want to see her get older. I want to see how this changes. I don't want Steve Carlsberg to always be the person that Cecil hates. I want them to have a good relationship maybe, or a different type of turbulent relationship, you know, something that's less one-sided. You know, so I think those limitations are good in a way because it focuses you on what it is, the stories you're trying to tell and the arc you want to build through. Thank you.
Jeffrey and Joseph are going to, again, be signing books in the back, so please join us in buying books, supporting their work, and please join me in thanking them right now.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.